But we begin with the U.S. response to Ebola and some aggressive state quarantine protocols that are at odds with CDC federal recommendations. Authorities faced harsh criticism this weekend from members of the medical community for treatment of a nurse isolated after returning from West Africa. New York's Governor Cuomo and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie were accused of overreacting in their responses to suspected infections. Both governors have since announced over the weekend that they have relaxed their quarantine orders. The nurse, suspected of infection, has been sent home to Maine with a clean bill of health. Meanwhile, Dr. Craig Spencer, the Doctors Without Borders physician who contracted the disease, continues to receive treatment at Bellevue Hospital here in New York. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Eric Mannheimer, chief medical officer at Bellevue Hospital from 1997 to 2012. He's currently chief medical officer of a home health care business called Home Health Care. Dr. Mannheimer, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
Bellevue is ready for something like this, right?
I think with the episode that happened in Lagos, Nigeria, and a lot of attention given to what the effects could be in New York City, there was preparation and time to get Bellevue as the designated center and to prepare it for a case.
There's a lot of history of Bellevue being the place where the difficult cases go, where the lessons are learned, and it's also has a reputation for being a very sort of safe quarantine set off from the community. It does some of the most somber work in healthcare in New York City.
That's true. It's had a long history, John, in many different areas. One is from the psychiatric point of view, it's a very large psychiatric facility. It takes care of the prisoners from Rikers Island, so it has a whole corrections facility of 100 beds. But even more than that, it has been a designated place to handle infectious disease problems. And one of the interesting facts is that Tom Frieden, our current head of the CDC, was really in charge of the epidemic of tuberculosis that began in the early 90s when Bellevue created an isolation unit on the floor where the patient with Ebola is now to help contain the disease in patients with highly infectious TB that for different reasons couldn't continue to take their medications.
And we should point out that while Ebola has a fatality rate that sets it apart from other infectious diseases behave in a very similar way in terms of their transmission, whether it's airborne or through bodily fluids. Controlling infectious disease is really the key. It's not so much the scariness of the virus that is the biggest concern.
That's absolutely true. Preventing the disease and controlling the disease can be done using very well-known, well-defined public epidemiologic methods. And taking care of this patient using barrier protection and different kinds of protective gear to protect the healthcare workers is essential.
How does a hospital like Bellevue prevent the situation that occurred with the nurse where she felt like she was being arrested and put in some sort of a prison? I mean, you do have to balance, I suppose, civil rights. Certainly you want to keep people comfortable when they're in a quarantine. There must be a certain amount of frustration, even if it's a hotel room that they're in. Do you have any comment on what went on this weekend?
I think it was unfortunate that the nurse felt that she was really under sort of lock and key and separated from her family and put in a very uncomfortable situation. I do believe it was an overreaction by the governor of New Jersey and even by the governor of New York initially. However, they were responding to very public fears and perhaps a ambiguous or conflicting messages from the CDC about that every hospital can take care of this problem, where it's very clear that every hospital can't take care of this problem, that you really need to have designated centers. I think for returning healthcare workers from West Africa, it's critical that they get treated respectfully. There's a 21-day incubation period. It's well known. They can clearly be at home and just be checked on regularly by public health workers to make sure that they're okay and where they are, et cetera, et cetera. But one does not have to go overboard and sort of have them imprisoned. That's really a contradiction.
It's a contradiction, but it is consistent with a disturbing history in America of the way we treated people at Ellis Island in terms of infectious disease, the way we've treated various kinds of epidemics in the past in the United States, a certain xenophobia that translated into some very questionable public health decisions.
But looking more recently at diseases like SARS and some other things, these were not implemented. So they weren't this restrictive quarantining. I think the key fact here is that the epidemic is really going wild in West Africa, and that is the source of and can be the source of continued spread throughout the globe. And we need healthcare workers. It's been noted that we need probably 250 healthcare workers for every 100 patients that are being treated in West Africa. So we'll need thousands of volunteers to go to West Africa, both physicians, nurses, and ancillary personnel who are highly trained in how to use this protective equipment and do case tracing and disease monitoring and data management. So it's critical. We're going to need a critical workforce of thousands and thousands of dedicated people to go there to help contain this virus.
I know enough doctors to know that regardless of where their life is at this point or whatever is going on with them, how old they are, whatever, they always ask themselves, would I go? Have you asked yourself that question?
I was in Haiti in 1985 during the when HIV just was being described but wasn't even defined as a disease. And we had cases of patients with lung infections called pneumocystis carinii, skin infections called Kaposi sarcoma, and we had no idea. And there were physicians from all around the world, myself included, and we took care of the patients. Every day we saw all kinds of diseases and highly infectious diseases that were lethal. So I think there are physicians are highly motivated to do the right thing. This disease's lethality, it's over 50%, puts it in a slightly different character where we've had now over 100 healthcare workers die from the disease and over several hundred infected with the disease. So we're dealing with a different circumstance.
I've heard someone say that Ebola chooses healthcare workers. It feeds particularly on healthcare workers. Before we go, that's a chilling assessment from an ER doctor that we talked to.
I think it's a disease of poverty. It's a disease in West Africa that has caused enormous destruction in an area that's been destroyed by civil wars and massive poverty and is now highly infiltrated by the narco mafia.
Dr. Eric Mannheimer, Chief Medical Officer at Bellevue Hospital from 1997 to 2012, currently Chief Medical Officer of a home health care business, Home Health Care. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
In West Africa, the monitoring of Ebola is not something that can be done in isolation chambers, with a conservative 2,705 reported deaths in Liberia thus far. The treatment is in every village. It has affected the way people deal with each other. It has shut down schools. It has left orphans in families already ravaged by civil war. Janice Cooper is the acting chair of the psychosocial Ebola incident management team for the Liberian Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. She joined us from the treatment center she is working in to help children and families affected by Ebola.
We are in what's called an Ebola command center. And in this really large room, if you can imagine the size of a kind of a warehouse or a garage, we have these different tables. The table I'm on is the psychosocial table. Right behind me are the experts that are working on social mobilization and across the way, case management. So it's a very, very busy place.
Superficially, people must imagine here in the United States that the psychosocial challenges are keeping people from panic and fear. But, with children without parents and families decimated and whole villages destroyed, I imagine the challenges are much, much greater than simply holding people's hands and making them feel less afraid.
Yeah, and in this epidemic, you can't really hold people's hand either, because that is one of the ways, if they're sick, that the virus gets spread. So from a psychosocial perspective, we really are talking about fairly complex trauma for some people. If you think about a country that endured 15 years of civil war, and we're just recovering from that, and some of the horrors of that, and for many people, they still had unresolved trauma from that. And then you think about the trauma that's associated with a disease where within the space of less than a week, sometimes less than a day, your whole family might be wiped out. We have to be very careful when we're training the clinicians and the social workers that are working on this, that their very knee-jerk and natural instinct to go and hug somebody or hold them may not pertain in certain cases, for example, with people who are just entering an ETU if they're not wearing protective clothing. And we even have to teach them within the context of groups when you may have people all together in a group and someone suddenly starts showing symptoms. They can't go to the natural instinct of holding somebody or comforting them in the same way with the same touch as they would if we weren't dealing with an infectious disease. So it is very complicated, very complex.
What is the future and the challenges and worries that you would have as a public health official about the young people who have come of age during this entire period? Perhaps in the middle of the Civil War, they were youngsters, and now they're teens and becoming young adults in the middle of this epidemic.
I think, John, that we will have a lot of children that are struggling to see where the future is, and they've already lost ground. So imagine children who are thinking about where are they going to get the education and where are they going to get the support to be able to have productive lives, to make sure that those children feel that there is a future. We believe that's a future post-Ebola, and it's our job to make sure that as quickly as we can, after the crisis, reprogram so that children can be back in schools and feel supported and feel nourished and then have the hope. That's especially important in terms of job training and in terms of giving them opportunities in life.
Janice Cooper, acting chair of the Psychosocial Ebola Incident Management Team for the Liberian Ministry of Health and Social Welfare, speaking there from the command center in a huge warehouse in the middle of Monrovia. Janice, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.